Welcome to Your Call. I'm Angie Quero. Rose Aguilar is on vacation. She is back tomorrow. Credit card debt is common in our society. It's a norm. It's nothing to be ashamed of. Approximately 91 million American adults have unpaid interest-bearing credit card debt, and another 24 million adults have had unpaid interest-bearing credit card debt at some point in the last year. That's two people paying interest on credit card debt to every one person with a student loan debt. That gives you some perspective. Those adults who do have credit card debt are paying a total of $121 billion annually in interest. The growth of credit card companies has exposed millions of Americans to predatory marketing strategies by banks. Those banks exploit common weaknesses in how we think about money. They lure people into lines of credit that, in many cases, those people can't pay back. On today's Your Call, we're speaking with Elena Botea about her new book, Delinquent, Inside America's Debt Machine. Elena is a former insider at Capital One. She has firsthand knowledge of how companies, like her former employer, have failed to make life better for some Americans in debt. We'll discuss how these banks profit by using marketing tactics and customer management strategies to exploit our common weaknesses and fantasies in how we think about money. What can be done to stop the banking industry from taking advantage of ordinary people while at the same time hanging on to the benefits of credit card debt? We'll explore those too. What would credit card use and interest look like in an ideal world? Elena Botea is with the philanthropic investment firm Omen Yard Network. She's a principal on its Reimagining Capitalism team, where she focuses on corporations and capital markets. It's right on topic for today's discussion. She's a former senior business manager at Capital One and author of the new book, Delinquent, Inside America's Debt Machine. Elena, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I want to set the stage with how credit cards and credit card interest look to Americans, how they're perceived. Is it perceived as borrowing, as one loan after another? Do people look at it the same way they would essentially taking little bank loans?
That's a great question. And it actually kind of speaks to this history of debt in America. So prior to the 1970s, most of the time, if an American needed to borrow money, they took out what we sometimes call an installment loan. So if anybody has an auto loan or a home loan, even a student loan, you're kind of familiar with this idea that you borrow amount of money. At the outset, you know how much you're borrowing or the principal, and you have usually a fixed number of payments. And in that system, most of us can figure out how much we're going to eventually pay. So about 85% of Americans are kind of skilled at this basic mathematical concept of just multiplication and kind of comparing these two different costs. So that's kind of the level that most of us on a day-to-day basis think. But starting in the 1950s, and then especially in the 1970s, that kind of falls out of favor for a number of reasons. And people start to use credit cards instead. And I talked to one borrower named Joe who really illustrated this idea. And he told me that, and he's someone who struggled with credit card debt, sometimes to the point of not being able to eat for a few days while he's waiting to pay his credit card bill. Mm. And what he told me is the first time he really understood how expensive the credit card was actually when he had to get an auto loan. And that auto loan, which had a lower interest rate, sort of like 5%, he was able to see, wow, I'm paying thousands of dollars of interest for this car. It's adding a significant part of the total expense. And only then did it click just how expensive the credit card debt was. And I think there's this big difference. When I talk to borrowers around the country, they don't feel initially like they're getting into debt when they make credit card purchases. And there's a big difference between, for example, let's say these purchases that are kind of in the middle. Let's say you want to go to a cousin's wedding or your mattress is really bad. You're not getting a good night's sleep. So not extreme luxuries, right? Not like a designer handbag, but also not putting food on the table the next day.
Right.
How do you decide if you're going to make those purchases? And with a credit card, it doesn't always feel like you're borrowing money. Whereas in the kind of previous system where if you had to go get a bank loan or even apply at a department store, that triggered for people this sense of I'm borrowing money. Is it really worth it? But in our current system, people really get in over their heads before they finally realize this is a very expensive way of borrowing money. And maybe I'm not even happy with the things that I bought in the great scheme of things.
There's a wide range of credit card interest, you know, up to, you know, 24, 25% in some cases. And you would think that there's a clear understanding on the part of someone who signs up for a credit card, exactly what that adds up to. And what we just heard from you about Joe, he kind of didn't get that. And I'm wondering about how the banks assign those credit ratings, whether it's the poor people who are getting subprime cards that are paying the highest interest, and how ironic that is in a way.
Well, what's really surprising to a lot of people who have never been in credit card debt, it's just the fact that you don't know your interest rate until after you've already submitted an application. And that's not so different than from other types of loans, this idea that you're not going to know your interest rate until you've already applied. But one difference with home loans and with auto loans is you can apply for as many as you want to within a month, and it all counts as one application for the credit bureaus. So every time you submit an application, it's a little ding on your credit score. Not a huge ding, but if you do a lot of these applications, it can really start to add up, especially for these people who are kind of struggling to get by and didn't have super high credit scores to begin with. So you're almost paying this cost or this price every time you apply. And that makes it really hard to figure out how to get a good interest rate. Not to mention this element that it's really hard for people to calculate what their interest is going to be or how much they're ultimately going to pay if they don't know how long it will take to pay back, if they don't even know what their credit limit is going to be. And that's, again, a big difference from the installment loan, and it is closely related to wealth. So what we see is that in middle class and wealthy neighborhoods, the average credit score is about 50 points higher than in working class and lower income neighborhoods. So wealth isn't the only thing that matters, but it certainly does matter. And what I think is also surprising to people is, you know, a lot of us have heard of FICO or Vantage, these big credit scores that are produced by the credit bureaus, but often those are not what's actually used on a day-to-day basis by the banks. So the banks are building their own custom proprietary credit scores that are using a wider range of types of information, often including income, which is not directly used in FICO. Mm-hmm. So people are kind of getting this education or this coaching from these credit monitoring systems and even from journalists in the media. And they're really kind of trained to think, well, FICO is all that matters, when in reality, the banks are building these custom models and using a wider range of variables, sometimes the variables that under closer scrutiny don't seem completely fair.
Mm-hmm. Even given that, and even given that banks can be absolutely usurious trying to, you know, get money out of people, I appreciate very much that the book is even-handed. It's the past, present, and possible future of debt, but it's not banks are all evil, credit cards are all bad. I mean, there's a lot of different stuff going on there. And I found that kind of encompassed in how you found it hard to answer this question, whether someone is better off owning less outright, but debt-free, or to own more, but to own money on it. And you admit that's actually a difficult question. The answer can be very nuanced.
Yes. And the reason I pose this question is because prior to the 1970s, if you were low income in the United States, chances were that you had no consumer debt other than perhaps a mortgage. So in the 1970s, people who were low income were often completely debt free, and that came with its own challenges. So if you weren't getting paid until the 15th and you needed to buy groceries on the 10th, obviously that's challenging, right? Like, I'm not going to sugarcoat the fact that that was very hard for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But the current system is hard too. So a lot of times lower income people end up in more debt than they can afford to pay back. And then they get what's called a wage garnishment lawsuit. And what's actually kind of surprising to people is that these wage garnishment lawsuits are actually taking up our court system, right? So more than half of all civil cases in the states are these wage garnishment cases. Mm. So it's impacting a lot of people. They're getting about 25% of their paycheck taken out to repay their creditors. And that's happening before babies are getting their diapers. It's happening before people are picking up their prescriptions. So it's a big hardship for a lot of people. But I think when we go back and we recognize, well, this isn't inevitable. This hasn't always been the case. It's not the case in every country that's, you know, middle or high income. It helps us remember that this system had to be built, right? And it was built by many people who are alive today. So this isn't something that is just an inevitable part of capitalism or an inevitable part of our society. It's actually something that was built in our lifetimes. And then that means we should scrutinize it and decide, is it working? But yes, I think you're right that it's really hard to tell whether access to credit is helping people or harming people.
Mm-hmm. You go into four different ways that debt comes to be perceived as a good, the four parts of the debt machine, really illuminating. Let's talk about part one, a market equilibrium, where the credit card is found to be appealing. How does that work?
Yes. So on the surface, credit cards look like a good deal. But part of the reason they look like a good deal is because, again, we don't understand the price. So there's this study that I love by an economist named Mary Zaki, who is at the University of Maryland. And she looked at what happened when department stores switched from these installment loans to revolving loans or credit cards. So in the 1950s, about half of all Americans had a Sears line of credit. So it was a very common way of borrowing money, JCPenney about a third. And when each company decided to switch from offering these installment loans to offering the revolving loans, profits went up and people borrowed more. And so there's this good evidence that it kind of just shuts off our brain, like the part of our brain that does math, the part of our brain that kind of makes these assumptions about like, oh, should I buy the name brand toilet paper, the less expensive toilet paper, the part of our brains that we're using normally to think about cost. So on the surface, this main borrowing instrument, the thing that most people use when they have to borrow money day to day, seems very appealing, but in fact is higher cost than most of us realize.
I want to get into parts two, three, and four of the debt machine, but I also want people who are listening to know, we want to hear from you. We're talking with Elena Botea. Her book is Delinquent: Inside America's Debt Machine. What are your experiences with credit cards? Have they made your life better? Have they turned out to be a net negative? And especially, what questions do you have about how the debt machine works? You can call us right now at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall@kalw.org, or you can tweet us. We're keeping an eye on Twitter, too, @yourcallradio. So let's get back to those little bits, the little cogs in the machine of debt. And there's the widespread belief that access to credit is a good thing, that it would be a policy failure if fewer people were able to get a loan. That's kind of counterintuitive, because common sense would tell you some people aren't capable of handling a loan, that they don't have the wherewithal.
Yeah, but it's amazing if you take a step back and you look at the types of conversations that are happening in Congress, happening even in grassroots communities. We're really anchored to this idea, both for people on the left and for people on the right, that it's really hard to get credit and there's all these people left out of the system, and that we need to be expanding access to credit as a form of opportunity. And I think a lot of that language was kind of set in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and we never really changed our way of thinking. So, of course, during those times, there was a lot of formal on paper discrimination against women and people of color. Of course, discrimination still exists today, but back then people didn't hide it, right? They're like, I'm not giving you a loan because you're pregnant, or I'm not giving you a loan because of the color of your skin. And interest rates were very low. So the maximum interest rate in most states set by law was either 8% or 12%. And inflation, like today, was high. So if you could get a loan in those days, it was a really good deal. And so this was something that was worth fighting for. Civil rights groups fought for it. Women's groups fought for it. Some really important laws were passed in the 1970s, but we're still using that same language that assumes that credit is really scarce. But what a lot of people know firsthand, even right after they declare bankruptcy, or even right after, you know, while they're not being able to pay their existing bills, they're still getting credit card solicitations. So that's one indication that the banks are willing to lend quite a bit. And it's because of these high interest rates, right? So when your interest rate is 24%, it's okay if half of the people eventually don't pay it back, right? Because 24, just multiply it by two, that gets you 48. So it's sort of this indication that a lot of people can default and the bank can still come out ahead.
And just parenthetically, you have to wonder how many trees have died for the you have already been approved credit card solicitations that go immediately into the recycling.
Yeah, Capital One was actually the number one user of the U.S. Postal Service for a long time. So kind of gives you this sense of how much the credit card companies have kind of taken over some of the cogs of just daily American life.
We're going to the phones here. We will come back to the remaining cogs in the debt machine, but I do want to talk to Mary from San Francisco, who wants to talk about debt and seniors. Mary, thank you for calling in.
Thank you very much. And you did a program on seniors and poverty the other day. And a lot of this, we can look at the banks, but a lot of this exists in a larger context with elder debt and the fact that our Social Security benefits are not keeping up with the economy and our Medicare. So it doesn't cover things that we absolutely need, such as N95 masks, hello, orthopedic shoes. And we're not getting dental and vision and hearing aids. We're getting the promises. So what we're actually doing, Medicare doesn't cover dental, vision, so many things we need, but Visa card does. We're using Visa card for health issues, for medical expenses, and this is not right. So there should be a special attention on elder poverty, making sure that Social Security does keep up. I just got an 8.7% raise in my Social Security benefits, and that's actually good for the economy as a whole. And I managed to lower my credit card debt from 24% interest to 1% by getting on an economic hardship program. But we need to keep up. There needs to be a way for seniors not to have to pay for what, because we're also using for food and utilities and for housing. And this just isn't right. So thank you for taking this comment.
Mary, thank you so much for that. And I want to tie this in fact, to the stories of Doreen and Michael and the others, Eleni, because you left Capital One, and we will talk about your time at Capital One. You left Capital One, and you traveled the country because you wanted to hear more about people's stories and their experiences with debt. Did you hear about senior debt?
Yes, and I think the caller is absolutely right that debt is not a substitute for a safety net, right? So sometimes people are forced to use it because that's all they have, but it's not a substitute for Social Security. It's not a substitute for unemployment insurance or just for making sure that working people and people who are not able to work because of disability or other reasons can live with dignity, right? And for seniors especially, that after a lifetime of hard work that they don't have to skip medicine or have to skip, of course, these other things that are not covered by Medicare, like hearing and dental, as the speaker pointed to. For these seniors in poverty, what we're seeing is that on average, older people have a little bit less credit card debt than people in middle age or younger people. But for those who do, it's very, very challenging. So I talked to some folks either at retirement age or past retirement age, like Catherine in Sacramento, who yeah, it's really cutting into, for higher income people, it's cutting into the type of life that they thought that they were going to be able to have in their kind of golden years. And for lower income people, it's cutting into their ability just to provide basic necessities for themselves, right? So I think it really speaks to this idea that I think, again, we're baked into this idea that credit card debt or debt can be helpful because we still think of this myth that our incomes are always going to keep rising, right? Mm-hmm. And in the 30s, 40s, 50s, it was true that, you know, if you had a good job, your income was going to go up year over year and that kids were doing better than their parents did. But when that's not true, you know, for an older person who's no longer going to be able to earn as much, or just for a whole generation of people who are not earning more than their parents, the credit card debt is going to just always cut into more and more, like mm-hmm. their ability to buy things next month and the month after that.
One of the parts of the debt machine is what you call a prevailing sense that not having a credit card is low status and a form of social exclusion. And that speaks to the fact that it's just become the norm that you have at least one, possibly three credit cards in your wallet, in your purse at any given time. And I really want to talk about that low status. It's not just that you're unusual. It's that there's kind of something wrong with you not to have that.
Yes. And I talked to so many people that the reason they got their first credit card is either somebody told them, you need this to build credit so you can buy a house one day. There's some truth to that. Or just who kind of communicated this idea that this is what you do in adulthood, that this is how you know that you've made it into professional life and that you're not a child anymore. And so what happens when that's the way people think is that often, you know, they're not making a lot of money in their first job out of high school or out of college. And they start to use a credit card initially just to buy things that they need, but then they're not keeping super close track. And all of a sudden, okay, they've spent a little bit more than they earned that month. And it just gets worse and worse over time. And really kind of comes from this fact that in the 1950s, you did have to be like kind of rich to get a credit card, right? And mm-hmm. they were marketed towards these elite businessmen. And that mentality of, you know, this credit card is a form of status that we see today with like metal credit cards, fancy rewards, airport lounge access. It's really this idea that, yeah, credit cards mean that you've made it, which is ironic when you just remember, okay, like in a certain sense, needing a credit card indicates that you like need to borrow money, right? That you're not making it in some other way. But we've kind of pushed that idea to the back of our minds and pushed it to the front of our minds that having a credit card means that you have high status.
I especially appreciated your delving into the idea of, you know, when you have the metal credit card, how you are perceived. You must be one of, you know, the upper folks. It's funny because it's completely an artificial construct.
Yeah. And it's not super cheap to make those credit cards. I think I remember it being sort of in the $10 range to make those metal credit cards as opposed to like 85 cents to make a plastic one. Mm-hmm. Right. And like it's always helpful to think about whose money is paying for that, right? It's your own money, right? And your own money is really paying as well for these airport lounges, right? So it's, I think those costs are not always salient.
We're talking about the book Delinquent, Inside America's Debt Machine, with the author of that new book, Elena Botea. It's time to take a bit of a break here on KALW, during which we will line up your phone calls at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can email your call at KALW.org or tweet your experiences, your questions, your comments at Your Call Radio. Rose is on vacation for one more day. I'm Angie Carter, who's sitting in, and you're listening to Your Call on KALW. Welcome back to Your Call. I'm Angie Carter, in for Rose, talking to Elena Botea. Elena, some of this comes from your own story. You took an internship at Capital One when you were 22. You said part of the reason you stopped working there was because you stopped believing that the work you did was good for the world. You were also hearing some amazing stuff there, such as the idea that raising interest was good for the consumer, which is, you know, a real kind of swallowing your own tongue sort of shock. Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think it reflects this mindset that's actually very common in the business community today in every industry, right? Which is this idea that over the long run, companies that do right by their customers and treat workers well are going to be more successful. And I think there's a lot of truth to that claim. And, you know, when people believe that, it can also encourage them to behave more responsibly in business. So there's some good pieces to that idea. And I think there's a lot of truth to it as well. But what I've found also is that business leaders flip it on its head. So they say, well, if I've been making a lot of money for 20 or 30 years doing this thing, it must be good for customers, right? And so I talk about in the book this meeting that I had with a new boss. So he had just switched divisions and I was reporting to him, moved from Texas. And we were talking about what our big picture goals for the year were. So, and for folks who work in banking or tech or kind of these white collar jobs, you know, you hear about ideas like agile and products and like these kind of buzzwords that are very popular. So we had those sorts of goals up on the board and of course completing our tech transformation, which ultimately resulted in the data breach that probably a lot of people remember from a few years ago. But we weren't talking about making money, right? And so, you know, one of the projects we had already decided to do was to test out offering higher interest rates. So I believe at the time, the highest interest rate we offered was 26 or 27. We were going to push it up to, you know, considering 29 and do a little randomized experiment to see what it meant. And so I just asked the question, you know, that doesn't ladder up to any of our goals. Mm-hmm. Should we have it on the board? And my boss said, well, it ladders up to this goal of helping customers succeed, right? Because if the interest rate is higher, then, you know, they're going to be better off, right? You know, they're going to borrow less money. And that idea, it was actually hard for me in the moment to tell, is that just a really off-color joke? Or is that what he really thinks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you've gotten to this point where you realize this whole foundation of this company and of, you know, my day-to-day work, I was there for 5 years, is really rooted in people deluding themselves and telling themselves story, right? Because I think we would never say, oh, it's good for people if the price of bread goes up or milk or diapers, right? And credit cards are what people use to buy those things, right? And like the idea that you would want to make a product that you wanted people to use less of sort of speaks to this idea that on some level you also know that the product is bad, right? And so mm-hmm. that moment where I realized, you know, to use a metaphor, how much of a house of cards it all was, made me step back and say, I need to understand this system better.
And there was a personal element to that, because the sentence that stood out to me from the book is, the idea that I might be a wolf never crossed my mind. We tend to think of banks and corporations as huge pieces of the cog, huge cogs in the big machinery, but they are all made up of individuals. So what did you finally see as your place in that machine?
Yeah, and I think there's this tension. So I hope people will pick up this book, even if they aren't super interested in credit cards or credit card debt, but who are just thinking about their own role at a company. And most companies, I think today, do a mixture of good and bad things, right? There's only a few companies I can think of that always treat their workers well and don't pollute that much, right? And there's this tension between these two ways of thinking, right? So one way of thinking is that all of these problems in capitalism are systemic, right? And I know when I left Capital One, they found someone to replace me, right? And that person, maybe they were good, maybe they were bad, maybe they made different decisions than me, but ultimately I was replaceable. And like, of course, the system has definitely continued without me. Credit card debt continues to rise. So there's that one extreme of this fatalism, right? Like, the system doesn't depend on me, so it doesn't matter if I work in it or not, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to keep going no matter what, versus this other extreme of everybody's accountable for what their company does, right? So, and where do you draw the line, right? Is the janitor who sweeps the floors accountable? Is a college hire who just started accountable? Is filling out spreadsheets? Is the CEO, I think we would say, well, the CEO is probably accountable. And ultimately, I don't think this has easy answers, right? But I did decide that, you know, I think for those of us who are lucky enough to have some choice in our career, and of course, many people don't, many people are in really precarious work situations.
Mm-hmm.
But for those of us who do have the chance, I think there is this obligation to find ways to challenge the system, right? And so for some people, that might mean, you know, as I did, which I was, you know, I was able to do this because I had a lot of savings from working for a bank, right? But, you know, I chose to step outside the system and write a book about it. But there's other ways to challenge it, both inside and outside these companies. So I hope people will take away that idea of having some agency, right? Like some ability to push back against these bigger systems that are not always fair.
That, in a sense, leads to an off-air caller that we had. And wow, what a great point, and I can't believe it didn't occur to me to ask about this. The caller who wanted the question asked on the air asked about places that don't take cash, they only take credit cards, and that really contributes to the whole haves and have-nots. You have the Amazon stores where you go in, you pick up what you want, and everything's automated. You walk out, and everything's deducted from your account. not everyone can do that. And our caller wants to know, what should seniors do, or anyone for that matter, who can't afford credit cards?
Yeah, so about 20% of Americans don't have a credit card at all. And those people tend to be lower income than the people who do. And of those, about roughly half have a debit card, so they have another way to pay digitally. But about 10% of the population, a little bit less than that, just they don't have a credit card, they don't have a debit card, that they're really left out of the system. And of course, the, you know, I think some of these companies that do it, you know, the places that offer $18 salads, you know, if you, those salads aren't affordable anyways, right?
Right, so, right.
In that sense, I think some of these companies kind of know who their customer is, but it is of course a big problem, right? If this Amazon Go is the place to buy fresh produce in your block or near your office or where you work or where you live, then it does matter, right? And so sometimes we're seeing companies find innovative ways to support people who have to pay in cash, right? So companies that are letting you go to your 7-Eleven to pay your bill, you know, like use these network of stores around the country that are often in lower income neighborhoods and let people pay in cash that way. So I think for people who are locked out of the system, investigating, you know, whether they're the companies, you know, their utility company, their, you know, internet company offers these sorts of programs can be helpful. But yeah, it gets at this broader picture, right? That, you know, I think when people are in a challenging situation, we all want to find a way to, I think sometimes offering people advice is a way of letting ourselves off the hook of being like, well, this person doesn't need advice. They really need help. And like, who's obligated to provide that help? And if I am I obligated to provide that help? And so, you know, I do talk about these tips of like how to find a better deal on a credit card, and how to pay less interest and how to navigate the system, some of which are based on my inside experience. But oftentimes, like, the system is bad, right? Like, there's, if there was a good way for people to deal with all these problems on a personal level, then we wouldn't have such a problem, right? And so it speaks to this idea that like, yeah, you should try to make the best decisions that you can, but also find ways to work with other people to change the system too.
You know, I want to talk to you about Doreen, because I think Doreen defies a lot of the cliches about borrowing. She literally was living in a park. She was living outdoors. Her one possession was her computer that allowed her to work. And when her campsite was rained out, she went to a hotel, and that started the thought process. Here she was out of the rain with relative comfort, and she took the risk of borrowing money on a credit card, and it literally changed her life. We tend to think that, oh, well, that was foolish on her part. She doesn't have enough income. She can't even afford a house. But this illustrates one of the ways that credit cards can work to the good. She took what she considered to be a responsible but challenging step, and it literally made her life better.
Yeah, so she took the train. She was living in Fresno, as you say. She was living in a park, gets this hotel or motel room, using actually at first a payday loan, so that her laptop won't be destroyed in this like massive rainfall event, in which actually several people died in this rainfall event. So it was a significant event for the region. And then she at first gets this credit card to try to pay off the payday loan that she was under. And she gets a credit line that's a little bit higher than that amount. And what she realizes that she can do is, you know, she's living in a high cost of living area, and a lot of the West Coast is high cost of living, so there's not always an easy out there. But what she does is she buys an Amtrak ticket and takes the train up to a more affordable part of the Pacific Northwest, and finds basically what she thinks is like the cheapest single rental occupancy apartment on the West Coast. And because it's so much cheaper and that she has more stability, more reliable internet access, she's able to make not a huge amount more, but a little bit more online, and also pay much less, right? Because that's less expensive than, you know, one motel room every few months, right? Even. Mm-hmm. So yes. And I think I really had to sit with this story because I think it illustrates the fact that we need to be really careful, right? When we're trying to write legislation or create new regulations or just tinker with the system, right? Because there's a lot on the line for people. And, I think I started this process thinking, well, I'm going to add up all the stories like Doreen, who benefited from credit cards, and maybe Joe, who didn't. And I'm going to figure out if this is good or bad. And I think that was a little naive in the way, because you really can't add up human suffering or human flourishing, right? It just doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. But what we can do is like pressure test the system against these different stories and think about, well, what would have happened to this person with this law or this policy in place?
Right. You talked in an article for the New Republic in 2019 about when you worked with Capital One, you oversaw the secured card product. Now, that credit card was marketed to people whose credit was so bad they couldn't get a credit limit of $300 at 27% interest unless they put down a security deposit. So how did they go about, Capital One, go about targeting people with poor credit in their ad campaigns? That's got to be quite the job of persuasion to get a credit card into those folks' hands.
Yes. So one thing, I think people kind of intuit this, but maybe don't know exactly how it works. So for direct mail solicitations, basically what the banks are allowed to do is go to the credit bureau and say, give me the names and addresses and information, maybe of everybody living in Texas or Louisiana who has a credit score that's between 500 and 600, who doesn't have a student loan, right? So they can ask for this very granular information. And the only real rule is that you have to then send all those people an offer of credit. And so that's how kind of the basis for targeting. And then what they're going to do is run all these different experiments. So they're going to say, not just kind of this simple thing that maybe people might be thinking of like, oh, is a blue envelope better or a red envelope better? Mm-hmm. But they're going to get down to, you know, which envelope is better for homeowners versus renters, which one is better for people who do have a car, people who don't have a car, but then also tinker with rewards or no rewards and a higher interest rate or no rewards and a lower interest rate. Should I have a teaser, 12 months, no interest, or a lower interest rate? So tinker with all these different variables until what they find is exactly what works for that person. And what's really sad about these secured cards specifically, which is, again, the highest risk card to the people who are struggling the most, is they're really marketed as this opportunity to build credit. And it is true, if you take out this secured card or really any type of credit card and you pay it in full every month, it can be relatively affordable and your credit score is likely to go up. But the problem is that for the secured card, which are again marketed as a way to build credit, more than 2/3 of the folks who have that card ultimately are going to borrow money, and often quite regularly. So these are really money makers for the banks, right? Because they're collecting a lot of interest and they already have the security deposit, right? So it's honestly pretty grim, right? And it really gets to this idea again of this the spin that happens in the companies where people say, well, this is a good thing to be offering to people because it's a way to build credit, and kind of eliding the fact that these are also very profitable products because of all of the interest and late fees that are collected, which are really people, and if you don't have a secured card, you're borrowing money from a bank. But if you do have a secured card, you're often really, if you think about it, just borrowing the money from yourself at a very, very high price. Mm-hmm. So it can be harmful and challenging for a lot of people who end up struggling.
If you're just tuning in, this is Your Call. I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Rose today. Elena Buteo is my guest. She has written the book Delinquent: Inside America's Debt Machine. Our phone number, if you'd like to contribute, 866-798-8255. You can tweet at Your Call Radio or email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk about efforts to regulate the credit card industry. And what is it that cries out for regulation? And again, I want to emphasize, the book does talk about how credit cards work well for some people, despite the interest. And the interest is, the big story here. But it can work well for people. So how do you go about regulating credit card companies, including interest, without sort of paternalistically shutting down that opportunity for people of perhaps lower income?
Yeah, so I think the kind of big picture idea that I think about is how do we put more power back in the hands of consumers to make their own decisions, and kind of that means shifting some power away from the banks, right? And I think we have this narrative in our heads that if you get a credit card, you made the decision, it was your choice. But I want to use this example that I think a lot of people will relate to, which is if you've ever tried to manage what you eat for health reasons or for other reasons. Before COVID, people probably remember people bringing in donuts into the office. And then when that, you know, box of donuts is there, oftentimes it's an uncomfortable feeling for people, right? You're like, am I going to eat this donut? Am I not going to eat this donut? Now, if you would have gone downstairs to the cafeteria to buy a donut and then it's free, that's probably great. You're like, I love donuts and I was going to get one anyways. Now it's free. But if you were trying to eat healthy that day, you might just be unhappy that the donuts are there, right? And so you're in this constant state of temptation where you're in this uncomfortable position. So one of the types of regulations that I think would make a lot of sense, which is so, so simple, but I think would make a big difference, would be before banks raise people's credit limits on their credit cards, to just ask them, do you want this higher credit limit or not? Right? Because today it's kind of equivalent to somebody dropping off like a cake on your front doorstep, even if you're like, I don't want to eat cake, like I'm trying to eat lentils and carrots today. And like whether in this cake getting dropped off, even if you've kind of asked for it to not be there.
Right.
Right? So they're always kind of pushing the boundaries of consumers and sort of purposely putting them into these uncomfortable situations. And so something just as simple as saying you shouldn't be able to change somebody's credit limit without their consent, I think sort of speaks to these types of changes that we can go and move in the right direction to put power back in the hands of consumers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there have been earlier efforts at legislation, obviously, some of them successful. And the CARD Act was one thing that worked to the benefit of consumers. And this goes to the life of millennials and Gen Z, in, you know, on the whole with their relationship with credit. You write that millennials have fewer credit cards, they have less credit card debts, and the CARD Act actually affected their access to credit card debt. How did that work?
Yes. So you can still get a credit card if you're 18, 19, or 20, but there's some rules that went into effect when the CARD Act was passed about a decade ago. So one of the rules said that the banks can't market to you until you're 21. So they can't send you solicitations like the type we described before in the mail, that if you're between the ages of, you know, 18 and 20. And then they also said that if you're between those ages, when the bank is trying to figure out, can you afford to repay this or not, that they have to consider only your income and not income that's provided to you by your parents, which would kind of make sense, right? Because maybe people's parents support them while they're in college, but then don't provide that same amount of support or can't like aren't haven't offered to their kids to pay back their credit card debt. Mm-hmm. And so what's interesting is that the people who grew up after the CARD Act was passed are still in less debt than their older counterparts, right? And it's not that, you know, it was become forbidden for them to get a credit card, but they had to kind of go out and decide it was right for them, right? Because I think people know that credit cards exist, right? Like if you're in the United States, you probably see, if you have a TV, you see like 30 credit card ads a day, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it just kind of took that, put people in the step of having to kind of make that proactive decision.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a good thing. And a lot of other parts of the CARD Act too saved consumers a lot of money. So it didn't completely overhaul the system, but it did make some changes in the right direction.
I want to talk about the connection of credit card debt to a much larger picture, and that's America's their obsession with stuff. We've delved a lot into the idea of stuff and how we buy things that ultimately we don't need, that they're ultimately not fulfilling. And you actually kind of get into that in the book to a certain extent. You say that Americans regret a majority of the credit card debt they take on, and the credit cards may be funding good that aren't adding meaningful long-term value. It strikes me that if we could attack that consumerism, We would also be looking at a change in our attitude toward credit cards. Does that wash in your brain?
I think it does, yeah. And I referenced this NerdWallet study that found that 86% of people in credit card debt regret it, right? So I think that's an indication about like, oh, this isn't all about paternalism to take a look at this system, right? Like people, once they've been in debt for a while, often they're like, oh, that was not the right decision for me. And kind of this obsession with stuff is a part of it. And of course, I also write about there's many things other than stuff that people buy, you know, including some things that are quite imported. But it's really where people struggle, I think, the most are these purchases that are in the middle of in between true luxuries and things that people really need. But yeah, we've really built this economy that is rooted in this idea of like more, like this sense that we create economic growth by getting people to consume more. And I think that kind of tilts us away from other ways of thinking about how we could build a strong economy, right? So what if, you know, we added to GDP instead of having people, you know, buy more trinkets, having more people working to care for the elderly in their home so that they don't have to go into a nursing home, or more people who were there to help raise children and, you know, set them up for success. So I think, you know, there's so many ways to think about how to create economic growth that are not so tied to, you know, physical objects that often end up in landfills, but also are not tied to pushing people into debt that they can't afford.
Mm-hmm. After you bring us through the history of credit, the history of interest, and all the various things that have changed about borrowing over the years, you bring together the idea that what we might benefit from is a credit system that, and I'm quoting you here, combines the easy access to credit from the 2000s with the lower debt burdens of the mid-20th century. Can you say more about what that would look like?
Yeah, so part of it is making it easier to comparison shop for loans and bringing down the price. So interest rates are much, much higher now than they were in the past. And even since the 1990s, this is a good point of comparison because really the number of Americans in the kind of credit score profiles of the Americans that have had credit has kind of stayed the same since about the 1990s. So before that, you had more and more growth of the industry, getting more customers. It's kind of leveled off since the 90s, but the rates have not leveled off. So it used to be that Americans were paying interest rates that were about 8% higher than the bank's borrowing costs. And now they pay interest rates that are about 12% higher than the bank's borrowing costs. So that means kind of this net price has gone up by 50%. So a big, big cost. And this costs, you know, a typical family hundreds of dollars a year. So it's an indication that competition isn't working, right? It's an indication that people are not able to find the deals that are best for them because the prices are rising and rising. And so one example of how to kind of get us back to a better system is to make it easier for consumers to comparison shop. And actually, just in the last few months, the CFPB has kind of released a kind of a call for information about an idea that's actually along these lines. So asking banks to publish what the credit score or the average interest rates that they charge to low, medium, and high credit score customers. So I think that's a step in the right direction of making it easier for people to find the best deal for them.
You know, you can look at the reforms that Elizabeth Warren worked so hard to get through in Washington, and it is a bit of a preview of what it would take to really change something that key to the credit card system. And I'm really throwing a whopper at you in our last 2 minutes, but do you have any perspective on how to get changes through Washington?
Well, I think, you know, consumer pressure is going to have to be part of the solution, right? So we've seen, you know, a lot of back and forth on student loans, which was really the byproduct of a mass organizing effort. And I think that credit cards as a source of like political tension, it's kind of fallen out of favor. But having that sort of grassroots energy, I think, is going to be critical, which I think will mean kind of getting rid of some of this stigma that we have around credit cards today, right? You know, student loans, people aren't ashamed of it because it's reflective of status, right? It's like, I went to college and this is the cost of it and this is inevitable, right? But people are embarrassed to be in credit card debt. And so I hope this people who are in debt kind of leave with this feeling that the problem was not with you. The problem was with the system. And so pushing to change the system is like the ultimate way out of the crisis that our country is in.
In our last minute, what's your advice to people who want to take out new lines of credit?
So really try to do your best to assess the cost. This is really specific, but some but not all banks let you check through a pre-qualification tool to find out what your interest rate is going to be. So, you know, look for three of those tools and kind of comparison shop based on interest rate. Don't look at rewards unless you're 100% sure you're never going to have to revolve month to month. The interest rate is really what matters. So you want to get the lowest price possible.
This has just been a great hour, and I've learned so much. I hope our listeners did as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And you've been listening to Your Call. I'm Angie Correa. Rose returns tomorrow. My guest has been Elena Botea. She's a former industry insider at Capital One. Now she's working with the philanthropic investment firm Omidyar Network. She's on its Reimagining Capitalism team. We've been talking about her new book, Delinquent, Inside America's Debt Machine. If you've missed any part of today's conversation, you will find it online at kalw.org. Thanks much to B-Soul for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, we want to hear from you. Email us at yourcall@kalw.org. Yourcall@kalw.org. Or you can tweet us, while Twitter is still standing, at Your Call Radio, @YourCallRadio. I'm Angie Cairo. Thank you for making us welcome in your home. It's Your Call.